thought I had pulled it out by the root, it always came back, usually twice as large. It was the dream where I heard the whisper of the man who raped me. As it had been in real life, I never actually saw the man's features. He was only a shape, looming over me in the dark, talking to me in that whisper that seemed to come out of the ether, like it was everywhere and nowhere, all at the same time. There were parts of the dream that changed, like where it happened. Sometimes it would be my parents' house in Northumberland, or at one of the foster homes where I had spent time, or, more rarely, at the ground floor apartment where the attack had taken place. But the whisper, that was always the same. I would never forget it. As was typical, the entirety of the dream took place in the moments right before he attacked me. He was crossing the room, clamping his hand on my mouth, the leather of his glove against my lips. The dream never progressed to the actual rape. It was all about the anticipation of the horrible event. By the time I opened my eyes, it was 10:47 and I was drenched in sweat. My shift started at 11. Waffle House was only 5 minutes away, so I could still make it. There just wouldn't be time for a shower. I hoped the customers didn't notice I still smelled like fear. As I drove to work, I tried to think about Alex. Sometimes it hurt too much to do that. But this time I was able to settle on a pleasant memory, one from when I was still pregnant with him. It was during my second trimester. I had been experiencing the miracle that was Alex, squirming and moving for some time, of course. But his little flutters, which to me seemed big enough for the whole world to feel, were too faint for Ben to detect. Every time I forced him to put his hand on my belly, he would give me this forbearing smile, then eventually admit he wasn't getting anything. Then one Sunday morning, when neither of us had to be anywhere, we were enjoying lying in bed. Alex was being particularly active, and he was finally growing big enough to really pack a wallop. So I made Ben put his hand on my stomach. Not 3 seconds later, Alex shifted positions. Ben actually yelped and pulled away. He was so startled. He said it felt like a snake had slithered along his hand. For a while after that, we called Alex the snake, one of at least a half dozen nicknames we had for him. From then on, Ben was constantly asking me if Alex was awake and moving. If I said yes, Ben would talk to Alex, telling him he wanted a high five. Sometimes I pretended like I was losing patience and asked him if bro time could wait until after I showered or went to the bathroom or whatever. But mostly, I loved it. For the entire final trimester, I finally felt like we were actually sharing a pregnancy that up until then had been mine alone. As I pulled into Waffle House, I was enjoying the memory so much I didn't particularly pay attention to the 3 Augusta County Sheriff's cars in the parking lot. It wasn't unusual to see them there. We were right by the highway that served as the main artery for the county, one exit away from their headquarters. Then I got out of my car, and the next thing I knew, there were 6 guys dressed in black tactical gear approaching me from all angles. Several of them had their hands on their gun belts.
"Melanie Barrick, put your hands on your vehicle,"
one of them barked. I was so confused, I didn't immediately do anything. I just stood there in my greasy uniform, wondering what it was now. The guy in the lead closed the gap between us so quickly I couldn't back up fast enough to get away from him. He grabbed me by the wrists and slammed my hands against the hood of my car, then mashed the rest of me so I bent at the waist.
"Don't move," he ordered.
He ran his hands quickly down my torso, then up my legs, giving me a sickened shiver. Then he straightened me, pinned my arms behind me, and fastened them there. As he shoved me toward the car, I finally got enough sense about me to ask, "What's going on? Why are you doing this?" He didn't reply. "Would you stop?" I pleaded pointlessly. "Can you at least tell me what's going on?" That's when he finally said,
"You are under arrest for the murder of Richard Codery."
Chapter 45. Minutes before she had to go into district court Friday morning, one of the deputies at the courthouse had told Amy Kay the news. A body, with its skull bashed to pieces, had been found in Thorn Rose Cemetery, a few feet from the monument to Confederate General John Eccles. The deputy didn't know anything else. But midway through the morning session, when the judge recessed for a break, Amy checked her messages. That's when she learned the victim had been identified as Richard Codery. Amy had tried to call Jason Powers at that point. He would know that Codery had been the Coke Mom informant, but he might not know Melanie Barrick had been given Codery's name just 2 days earlier. There was no answer on Powers's cell, so Amy took the unusual step of calling his home. His wife said he had been out late patrolling, like usual, and was sleeping in, but that he would call as soon as he awoke. Amy went back into court, worried that this important time, those precious first hours after the commission of a crime, were slipping away without anyone realizing what was going on. She needn't have. The Stanton City Police had used Codery as an informant, too. Once the police department and the sheriff's office discovered their common interest in Codery, they decided to join forces in the investigation of his death. While Amy was in front of a judge, bringing to justice people who had failed to get their cars inspected in a timely manner, the combined resources of those two agencies were being put to work. By the time Amy broke for lunch, there was another update. Melanie Barrick was in custody. Still, it wasn't until close to 4 o'clock Friday afternoon, when she was back in her office, that she managed to get Powers on the phone.
"Heya," he said.
"Hey, sounds like you guys have been busy today."
"Yep, but it seems like everyone's favorite drug dealer had an even busier night."
Yeah, Amy said. "Now look, I've been in court all day, which means you haven't gotten your dose of prosecutorial precaution yet today. So I'm going to give it to you now. Are you sure it's her? I mean, don't get me wrong, I get why she has to be the lead suspect. But I was in Judge Robbins's office on Wednesday when he told her that if anything happened to Codery, he'd hold her personally accountable."
"Yeah, I already heard from the good judge 3 times today. I think if he had an electric chair in his office, he'd be ready to spark it up right now for her."
"Okay, so you know where his head is. But Melanie Barrick did too. Doesn't that seem a little, I don't know, brazen? To go killing a guy after a judge has laid down the law like that?"
"Yeah, but criminals don't respect the law. That's why they're criminals."
"I hear that," Amy said. "And I know at the end of the day it's probably her. I just want to make sure we're at least looking at other suspects. Guys like Richard Codery aren't known to have great life expectancies. There are probably other people who would love to bash his head in. Could it have been someone else he informed on? I don't want us to get tunnel vision here."
"Oh, you ain't heard yet."
"Heard what?"
"The ME called us a little while ago. Codery had Melanie Barrick's name and phone number on a piece of paper in his pocket, along with the words Midnight and Thorn Rose."
Amy digested this for a moment. It was the kind of evidence juries ate up with a knife and fork. The victim was practically reaching out from the grave to testify.
"So what are we thinking?" she said. "Codery gets a phone call from Melanie Barrick,
a woman he's informed on, to meet her in a cemetery at midnight, and he just goes out to see if she wants to swap recipes? Would he really be that dumb?
You didn't know Rick Coterie, Powers said, chuckling. Bless his heart, he was dumber than a bag of hammers.
I'm being serious.
So am I. It's entirely possible he didn't know it was Melanie Barrick he informed on. She probably used an alias when she was selling to him. Her real name wouldn't mean anything to him.
How could it not? She's been all over the paper since then.
Rick Coterie ain't exactly a newspaper-reading type, Powers said. He probably thought it was some kind of business deal, and he couldn't help himself. A guy like Coterie would sell out his mother for $100. If he thought going out to a cemetery at night would get him a payday, he wouldn't be too concerned for his personal safety, especially if he was meeting with a woman. He'd think he could overpower her. He didn't know she'd have a baseball bat.
Was the murder weapon definitely a baseball bat? I hadn't heard that yet.
Oh, I'm just making that up. Emmy said blunt force trauma, like we couldn't have figured that out. He said if there was just one or two impact sites, he might be able to give us a guess on what did it. But Coterie's skull was so busted up, we probably won't be able to tell. Coke Mom sure got her licks in.
If it was her, Amy felt like she had to interject.
Well, come on. Who else could it be?
That's the point. We have to not only prove it's her, we have to jump through the hoops of proving it couldn't have been anyone else, that we considered every possibility. If this really becomes a capital case, she'll get two attorneys. And then, as soon as she's convicted, she gets an automatic appeal before the Supreme Court. From there, Virginia is full of clever anti-death penalty lawyers. One of them will find a way to make the thing federal, and then it'll be more appeals. Our actions over the next 2 weeks are going to be scrutinized for the next 10 years by people we can't even dream of. We have to make sure we're doing everything right.
I know. And I've got a whole lot of people doing the wild goose chase thing for just that reason. We went through the cameras at the cemetery. Not that they showed us anything. We got our detectives and some city guys at the Howard Johnson, where Coterie was staying. They're dusting his room for prints and everything. Plus, we're canvassing all around the cemetery, trying to find a murder weapon, but also talking to folks who might have seen anything last night. If any other possibility comes up, I promise we won't look the other way.
Thank you, Amy said. Keep me in the loop, okay?
You got it.
As she hung up, she still didn't like what she was hearing from the Augusta County Sheriff. This had nothing to do with whatever suspicions about Powers and his office she had mostly rid from her mind. This was hard-won experience talking. Few things led to mistakes more than an investigation that was too sure of itself, or an investigator who was acting like he already had all the answers. Chapter 46. I was still in some kind of denial throughout the afternoon, as a series of hard-eyed sheriff's deputies shunted me from one place to the next. Even as someone who had been wrongly accused of a crime before, I retained this trust that something would soon emerge to clear me. They would find some physical evidence that pointed them to the real killer. A witness would step forward. Some smart person, like maybe Amy Kay, would figure out what was really going on. Something. While I was still at Sheriff's Office headquarters, I was allowed a brief meeting with Mr. Honeywell. I told him I knew nothing about how Richard Coterie met his end. I had been at home, alone and asleep, from about 9 o'clock onward, which didn't help my situation at all. I wished I had taken Marcus up on his offer for Thai food. I asked Mr. Honeywell if he could check with Bobby Ray Walters and secure the video of me driving up my driveway and then not leaving all night. Wouldn't that confirm my story?
No. Mr. Honeywell pointed out that a video capturing only a narrow slice of my driveway couldn't confirm that I hadn't left my house on foot or by some other means. Bobby Ray's paranoia wouldn't help me this time. Then Mr. Honeywell explained that even an ironclad alibi would have its limitations in a case like this. The prosecution would simply argue that I was a drug dealer with an extensive criminal network, the kind of person who could easily order a killing to be carried out by someone else. The law would treat me the same whether I pulled the trigger or paid someone else to do it. The prosecution's whole case would rest on motive, that I had such a compelling reason to kill Richard Coterie, I had to be guilty. I was soon swept off to the magistrate, who forwarded me without much delay onto the Middle River Regional Jail. It was a sad testimony to my state of affairs that I was starting to know their intake procedures so well. The surrendering of my personal effects, the signing of documents that I had no choice but to sign, the shuffling from one station to the next. Even the humiliation of the cavity search was starting to feel routine. When it was all done, when I was back in Jailhouse Orange, I was preparing to be packed off to the general population for more taunts from my fellow inmates, who would already probably know more about the circumstances of Richard Coterie's death than I did. I was being herded around in handcuffs by a corrections officer, and we had reached the point in the labyrinth of hallways where I knew we were supposed to turn right. Instead, he shoved me to the left. "Where are we going?" I asked. "Ad seg," he said coolly. "Administrative segregation, also known as solitary confinement." I had already heard it being hung over inmates' heads as their punishment for misbehaving. It involved being in a room by yourself for 23 hours a day, not seeing or talking to anyone else most of the time, not being allowed trips to the library or other liberties that made incarceration a little less intolerable.
"Ad seg? Why? I didn't even do anything," I said, already feeling the panic rising in me.
The guy chortled.
"That's not what I heard."
"No, no, wait," I said. "That's just an accusation. They haven't proven anything. I didn't do it."
The CO was still shoving me down this strange hallway.
"Yeah, I'm sure," he said. "Look, all I know is the warden said to put you in ad seg for protection."
"Protection? Who do I need to be protected from?"
The guy laughed some more.
"Not for your protection, sweetheart. For the protection of everyone else in here. You might as well get used to it. Once you're convicted, they'll put you in ad seg too. That's what death row is."
That moment, when he said the words, "death row," was when the denial faded away. The blood seemed to leave my head all at once, and my legs went out from underneath me. The next thing I felt was the floor. Dimly, I could hear the corrections officer call for medical assistance. I was not merely a drug dealer anymore. I was something far worse. A violent murderer whose flagrant disregard for the law had put me on a straight and narrow path to the death penalty. This was no 5-year sentence. This was spending the rest of my life, whatever remained of it, being treated like a feedlot cow on my way to slaughter. It would take a few years for me to exhaust my appeals, but not too many. I had read a story once about how Texas kills more people, but Virginia kills them quicker. It streamlines the appeals process, making it possible to go from crime to punishment faster than anywhere else in the country. I could suddenly see the time stretching out in front of me. It would be both incredibly long and all too short. The whole time, I would be Melanie Barrick, notorious murderer.
If Alex learned anything about his mother, it would only be that I was such an awful person, a series of virtuous citizens, judges and prosecutors and jury members alike, determined the world would be a better place if I were exterminated. There would be no chance to reunite with him, even in some limited fashion as the biological mother whose rights to him had been terminated. Social services would not permit a child to visit death row, and the Department of Corrections would not allow me to go anywhere else. I would go to my grave without ever getting the chance to hold Alex again. Chapter 47. The ruling came down from Judge Robbins's office first thing Monday morning. The motion to suppress the search warrant in Commonwealth versus Barrick had been summarily rejected. The judge had decided that, as a matter of law, it wasn't of consequence whether the confidential informant was lying or, for that matter, whether he was still breathing. The warrant was based on sworn statements from the sheriff's deputy. As long as the deputy was being truthful, and there was no allegation to the contrary, there was not sufficient grounds to overturn the warrant. There was no need for a hearing. The testimony of the late Richard Codery had been deemed legally insignificant. Moments after Amy Kay received the electronic notification of the filing, she also got an email from the judge's clerk, reminding her that the trial was still scheduled for April 9th. In case anyone didn't get the message already, the judge was determined the case would proceed with or without Codery. Amy was just digesting the implications of the ruling, and whether, in fact, it constituted reversible error that might later be appealed, when Erin Dansby appeared in her office doorway, looking positively chipper.
"Hey!"
he said brightly. "Hi," Amy said, shocked to see him on a Monday morning for the second time in a month.
"Did you see the ruling in the Coke Mom case?"
"Of course. Did you?" she said incredulously. She couldn't remember the last time Dansby had even been aware of a ruling on a defense motion.
"Yeah, I kind of knew it was coming," he said.
"How?"
He closed the door to her office behind her. "I was at the club over the weekend, and I bumped into Robbins," he said in a conspiratorial tone.
"Bumped into him?"
"Maybe I should say he bumped into me. Claire and I were there for dinner, and he came over and said hi. He brought up Coke Mom. Everyone at the club was buzzing about it."
Dansby invited himself to sit down. Amy sometimes wondered if he really should have been a tabloid newspaper reporter. Gossip and intrigue seemed to excite him more than the law.
"He might have had a few. You know how he loves his scotch," Dansby continued. "He sat down with us and was just going on about how we had to make sure Coke Mom didn't get away with this, and how we needed to send a message that we weren't going to let the criminals run things and all that. Then he told me he had already written up the ruling rejecting Coke Mom's motion, and that he was just waiting for Monday morning to file it."
"Did anyone hear you guys talking?"
"I don't know. Why?"
"Because what you're describing is an ex parte communication between a judge and a Commonwealth's attorney, and it's highly improper."
"Yeah, yeah, whatever. I haven't even told you the best part."
"Yes, because there was always a best part about ethics violations.
After he tells me he's rejecting the motion, he starts giving me advice about what we ought to do," Dansby said. "He was going on about how, when I was sitting in your chair, I would have blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he was saying we should keep on schedule and prosecute the drug thing first. That way, when Coke Mom comes up for trial for the Codery thing, she's already a convicted felon. He said that would make it more likely she gets the needle. What do you think? Can we do it that way?"
Yeah, sure," Amy said. She didn't like how any of this felt, a judge and a Commonwealth's attorney colluding at a country club, especially when the defendant had already asked for a bench trial.
Good. We're still solid on the drug thing, right?
Dansby asked.
I mean, now that he's rejected the motion, it's full speed ahead, right?
Yeah, sure. The warrant is lawful, so all the evidence gathered as a result is admissible. It makes things pretty straightforward.
Good. Good. What do you think? Should I send Robbins a bottle of Glenlivet for the free legal advice?
Don't you dare, Amy spat.
Kidding, he said. Then he winked at her. By the way, I'm thinking about doing this trial. When is it again?
April 9th, she said, trying not to show any reaction.
Okay, got it. Keep up the good work.
He rapped her desk twice with his knuckles as he stood up, then left her office. Amy waited until he was gone to frown at him. When he said he was doing this trial, he meant he planned to sit first chair, which was his prerogative as Commonwealth's attorney. For Amy, it would just mean more work. Getting Aaron Dansby ready for trial took, on average, about 3 times longer than if she had to prepare only herself. Amy settled back into her work, still pondering the strangeness of a judge telling a prosecutor how to do his job. Not 20 minutes later, her phone rang. It was Sheriff Powers.
Hey, it's Amy.
Hey, he said. You got court or anything this morning?
No, not till this afternoon.
Good. You're gonna want to come up here.
What's going on?
We got a guy who just walked in here and confessed to killing Richard Coterie.
As fast as her car and legs could get her there, Amy was seated in the conference room at the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. Lieutenant Peter Kemp was there. So was Sheriff Jason Powers. Amy smiled awkwardly at them. They didn't know about her pin map, or that, as she sat there, she still couldn't completely rid from her mind the possibility, however slim, that one of them was the man she had been hunting for 3 years. Then her focus changed to the man being brought into the room. He was tall, somewhat gaunt in the face, with broad shoulders. Amy pegged him as being mid-50s. He looked like he worked outside. She stood up, but the man wasn't going to make it over to her side of the room to shake hands. Powers pointed to the nearest chair, across the long table from Amy.
Sit here,
Powers said, and the man lowered himself into a chair. The sheriff looked at Kemp.
You got the recorder?
Kemp waved a small silver digital recorder in the air, then set it in front of the man and pressed a button.
All right, Powers said. You sure it's going?
Kemp gave the thumbs up.
Good. Then let's get on with it, Powers said. Sir, can you please state your name?
William Theodore Curran, sir. But people call me Billy. Billy Curran.
Thank you, Mr. Curran. You're here freely and voluntarily, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you've been advised of your right to counsel.
What do you mean?
That you can have a lawyer if you want one, Powers said.
Oh, yeah,
Curran said.
And you've waived that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, what is it you'd like to say to us?
Just that, you know, I did it,
Curran said.
You did what?
I killed that guy in the cemetery. Melanie Barrick had nothing to do with it.
The way he had said Melanie caught Amy's attention. It wasn't like he was talking about a stranger. There was a warmth underlying it. Then Amy made a connection. Curran, a common enough name, sure, But it was also Melanie Barrick's maiden name, the name she had been using at the time of her attack. Was this guy related? Powers was continuing with his questions.
Why did you kill him? Do I need a reason? I just killed him.
But did you know the victim somehow? Did you have dealings with him?
No, nothing like that. My wife and I were walking through that cemetery on Thursday night. We like cemeteries. We were minding our own business, looking at the dates on the graves. Then this guy started hassling us. I'm pretty sure he was doped up on something, and I got worried he was going to hurt me or my wife. So I killed him. It was self-defense.
Your wife was a witness to this?
Yes, sir, Curran said. I'll have her come here, and she'll tell you the same thing if you want. But she didn't have anything to do with it either. It was all me.
But when you say he was hassling you, what do you mean exactly?
Oh, you know, he started by asking us for money, and I told him no. I thought he was going to try to rob us. Then he started making threats about how he was going to take me out.
Did he have a weapon?
I don't know. Probably.
But did you see a weapon?
Yeah. I think he had a knife, Curran said. But I could be wrong about that. It was pretty dark.
So did he try to stab you or something?
I don't know. It happened pretty fast. I was just really scared, and he was making threats, so I killed him before he could do anything to me or my wife.
And why are you confessing to this?
Because I saw in the paper that some young woman had been arrested, and I didn't want someone else to have to pay the penalty for something I did.
But if it was self-defense, why didn't you just call the police after the incident?
Curran shifted in his seat.
Because I'm a registered sex offender. I'm supposed to stay out of trouble.
Oh, Powers said, as if that cleared up everything.
I didn't think anyone would care that some scuzzball had been killed, Curran said. And then I saw that young woman in the paper, so I thought I should come forward and clear the air.
Powers looked over at Kemp. Neither of them was likely aware of the Melanie Curran-Melanie Barrick connection. Still, this had to be one of the flimsier confessions ever recorded in the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. Amy expected this would be the point in the interrogation where the sheriff would delve further into the details of this story and expose its fraudulence. Instead, Powers said,
"Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming forward, sir. You understand we're going to have to arrest you and process you?"
"Yes, sir. You do what you have to do."
"Do you have a lawyer?"
"No, sir."
"Well, then the judge will probably assign you one."
Amy stopped paying attention to the back and forth. She had shifted her focus to Powers. Why was the sheriff letting this continue? Hadn't he been sure on Friday that Melanie Barrick was the murderer? Was he really that eager to clear a murder from his books that he didn't care he was obviously getting the wrong person? The pin map. The missing drugs. The Barrick raid. And now the eager acceptance of an obviously false confession. There wasn't exactly a straight line between all four of those things, nor was there any obvious benefit. How would punching this guy's ticket for a murder committed by someone else be of any aid to the sheriff? Amy couldn't figure it out. She just had to put a stop to it. A false confession would only muddy the prosecution of Melanie Barrick. "Hang on a moment," she said, forcefully enough that the heads of all three men turned her way. "Mr. Curran, I'm Amy Kay. I'm with the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. Do you mind if I ask a few questions?" Curran looked at the sheriff, who didn't give any response.
"I guess not," Curran said.
"Thank you. You said you were walking through the cemetery. Thornrose Cemetery is a big place.
Roughly where within the cemetery did this altercation take place?
I don't know. I guess you could say the middle.
After you killed the victim, did you move the body?
No, ma'am.
Amy glanced over at Powers for a moment. They both knew the monument to General John Eccles was closer to the western entrance of the cemetery than the middle. But that was splitting hairs. Really, Amy was only trying to get a rhythm going.
Did you touch the victim?
No, ma'am.
But you knew he was dead?
Yes, ma'am.
And about what time did this occur?
Middle of the night sometime. I don't know. I wasn't wearing a watch.
So, call it midnight, then?
Yeah, about that.
Well, that roughly matches our time of death, Amy said. But maybe you can clear something up for us. The victim was such a mess. The medical examiner couldn't tell if he had been struck by 2 bullets or 3.
How many times did you shoot him?
Curran didn't hesitate.
3.
He said.
Amy looked at Powers, who rolled his eyes and muttered a curse.
Well, now that I think about it, it might have been 2, Curran said. I don't know. I was pretty worked up, you know?
And Mr. Curran, Richard Coterie wasn't shot, Amy said. And you should know making a false confession is a crime.
Curran brought his head down to the table. When he finally looked away, he was blinking back tears.
Sorry, Melanie, he said. I tried.
It took another hour to clean up the mess that was Billy Curran. The sheriff was hopeful they could pretend Curran had never happened, but Amy wasn't hearing it. Failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, even a blatantly false confession from a relative, was a sure way for the prosecution to lose a conviction. They had to document this properly, then make the defense aware of it. Such was the burden of being the good guys. Amy was coming out of Powers's office, heading down the hallway toward the exit, when she heard a man calling her name. She turned to see the relentlessly close-cropped hair of Deputy Justin Herzog.
Hey, I was just about to call you, he said.
Oh, yeah? What about?
Got something to show you if you have a moment.
Sure, Amy said, and followed him into a cramped office. Herzog sat down and was already urging the cranky computer there back to life. Amy wondered if he already felt the desire to high-kick it.
Don't know if Sheriff told you, but you know that guy they found in the cemetery?
Richard Coterie.
Yeah, him. Sheriff must have thought I was bored or something, but you know we checked for prints in the hotel room where he had been staying, right?
Powers mentioned something about that.
Did he tell you I spent my whole weekend on it?
No, he didn't mention that.
Believe me, I'll remind him of it if he gives me trouble for the overtime. Anyhow, as you might imagine, there were a lot of prints in that room. A lot were partials that were pretty useless. Some of them were unsubs, he said, using the slang for unknown subjects. And, of course, some of them were the victim, whose prints were already in the system. But there was one unsub that caught my eye. It was a pretty good one, too. A lot of oil on this guy's fingers. They pulled it off the dresser, which is a nice, shiny surface. I'd say it was fresh, because the rest of the dresser didn't have any prints on it, which probably means someone cleaned it not too long ago.
Herzog was working the mouse. The computer's hard drive was clicking and clacking so much, Amy worried it was going to overheat.
Okay, here we go,
he said, having pulled up 2 prints onto the screen.
Now, you do this as much as I do, you actually start to recognize fingerprints. I knew I had seen this one before. It's like, well, it's almost like going through a crowd of people and seeing a familiar face. It jumps out at you.
Sure. Amy said.
You see this print?
He said, pointing to the one on the left side of the screen.
Yeah,
she said.
This is the one they pulled off the dresser from room 307 at the Howard Johnson.
Got it.
And I started thinking, where have I seen that before? Herzog said. I began running through recent cases in my mind. Then I remember the one from the Pritchett sexual assault, the guy we referred to as Person B.
The one I thought was Warren Plotz, but wasn't?
That's right. But guess who it is?
Who?
The guy from the dresser. I've already found 16 points of similarities. It's a dead-on match.
Amy Kay just stared at the screen. In other words, Amy began, but was too stunned to complete the sentence. Justin Herzog did it for her.
In other words, the man who raped Lily Pritchett was a recent visitor to Richard Coterie's hotel room.
Chapter 48. My new home was exactly 8 feet wide by 10 feet long. I know because I had nothing better to do than measure it, using an 11-inch sheet of paper as a ruler. Other than the heavy steel door, the only opening in the concrete walls was an 18-inch high slit of a window. That it existed, I had learned, was because the Supreme Court had ruled that all inmates, even those in administrative segregation, were required to have a source of natural light, the absence of it being considered cruel and unusual punishment. Mind you, the glass in my window was frosted, so I couldn't actually see anything outside. In that way, it was like the Middle River Regional Jail extending an 18-inch middle finger at both me and the Supreme Court. There were two sources of artificial light. One was the fluorescent bulb recessed into the ceiling and protected by a metal grate. The other was the 1 foot square, 2-inch thick piece of safety glass in the door, which let in light from the hallway. I had no control over either. The light above me came on automatically every day at 6 a.m. and stayed on until 10 p.m. The light in the hallway never shut off. It blazed at all hours, forcing me to sleep with my back to the door if I wanted any relief from the glare. Breakfast came at 7 each morning. Lunch was around noon. Dinner was 5:30-ish. All meals were delivered through the narrow slot in the door just below the window. There was a small ledge on my side of the door where the tray just barely fit, but the inmate who delivered it had to insert it gently or the food ended up on the floor. Some inmates waited for me to be by the door to receive the tray. Others just flung it in without caring. The only furnishings, if you could call them that, were the bed, the sink, and the toilet. The bed had a 3-inch mattress that did little to cushion my back from the hard surface underneath. The sink had only cold water. The toilet was a chunk of forged stainless steel with no seat and no way to flush. My excrement either slid down or did not. Sometimes, when it got stuck, I splashed water at it until it disappeared. Despite these grim conditions, I continued my attempts to keep my milk supply going. Doing my best to block out all the distractions, I would think of Alex, imagining his blue-gray eyes staring up at me, thinking about the moment when he latched on. It still felt like it took forever for the flow to start, and once it did, I was no longer drawing as much out. It certainly didn't help there was a camera box in the corner of the room, so I knew the guards, some of them male, could watch me. It was nearly impossible to be discreet. Stubbornly, I kept at it. I told myself Alex would be thankful. I also exercised, doing push-ups, sit-ups, wall squats, burpees, whatever I could manage in that small space. It was more about mental preservation than it was about the physical benefits. The other highlight of my existence was when one of the guards remembered to grab a book for me on their way into work. The Middle River Regional Jail's collection consisted almost entirely of genre fiction, mostly romances and mysteries. There was one I enjoyed enough to read 5 times. It featured a wisecracking investigative reporter named Carter Ross, and I was grateful for the temporary respite it gave me from reality. For 1 hour each day, and this, again, was thanks to the Supreme Court, I was invited to stick my hands through the meal slot and be handcuffed. I was then led to an outdoor cage that was wedged between 2 concrete walls. I didn't have a piece of paper with me, so I couldn't give exact dimensions. My best guess was that it was 15 feet square. Every few days, on a schedule I had yet to be able to discern, my hour in the cage was cut short by a shower, which I took under the watchful gaze of a female guard. This was my life, day after day. Recovering addicts talk about hitting bottom, about reaching that moment when they knew they could sink no lower, when they simply had to get sober or they would cease being recognizable to themselves as a human being. In a strange way, I envied them. At least they eventually found that lowest point. Not so in ADSEG. It was like hitting a new bottom every day. Chapter 49. Amy Kay's favorite class in law school had been a criminal law clinic she attended during her 3rd year. The professor began the first day by writing, "Follow the evidence," on a whiteboard in the room where they convened. The admonishment remained there the rest of the semester, set off in its own box, with, "Do not erase. This is the most important thing to remember from this experience," written in smaller letters next to it. Amy was now tempted to call that professor and ask what she was supposed to do if the evidence she was following didn't make a shred of sense. The man who raped Lily Pritchett and dozens of other women over the course of nearly 2 decades had visited Richard Codery's hotel room. Richard Codery, who had been, up until his untimely demise, the star witness against Melanie Barrick. Melanie Barrick, who was one of the rapist's victims. Was there a world where a drug snitch and a rapist just happened to associate with each other? It didn't fit any profile Amy had ever seen. And the murder had happened squarely within Stanton city limits. Did that mean her pin map was actually misleading evidence? Yes, this was a murder, not a rape. But had the rapist been operating in Stanton as well? Perhaps just in a way that didn't show up in the files? Raping, but not whispering? Amy had turned it every which way she could think. She had created flowcharts, timelines, and Venn diagrams, drawing lines and circles in a desperate attempt to make the patterns clearer. All it did was waste paper. After a few days of fretting over it, Amy decided it was either a wild coincidence, or it was a puzzle that would go unsolved for the time being. Meanwhile, the chief deputy Commonwealth's attorney had other things to keep herself busy. The medical examiner's report had come back on Codery, confirming the cause of death was blunt force trauma, and the manner of death was a homicide. It opined the victim had briefly tried to defend himself, enough that he might have left some superficial wounds on the perpetrator. But they were still waiting on toxicology reports and other physical evidence found on the body, all of which had to come from the state lab in Roanoke. Other avenues of investigation? The sheriff's canvas, the attempts to find the murder weapon, had led nowhere. Amy had also been tutoring Aaron Dansby, making sure he would be ready to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Melanie Barrick had possessed drugs with the intent to distribute them.
On Dansby's calendar, these appeared as strategy sessions. In Amy's mind, they were more like exercises in disaster mitigation. They involved trying to anticipate where her boss might screw up this time. During the Mookie Myers trial, Dansby had nearly forgotten to ask Detective Kemp an entire page's worth of the questions Amy had prepared. At a murder trial 2 years before that, Dansby told their smoking gun witness she could wait to testify in the courtroom, as opposed to outside of it. If Amy hadn't seen the woman sitting there moments before opening statements began, the witness would have been disqualified. The man just had an endless capacity for procedural incompetence, for as good as he could be on his feet. And Amy reluctantly admitted the man had some skills as an orator. He couldn't be trusted with the details. Throughout this coming trial, Melanie Barrick would be one Aaron Dansby blunder away from an acquittal. Amy had scheduled the first strategy session for Friday morning at 9:30 a.m. "Here's the list of questions for Kemp," Amy began, pulling a stapled piece of paper from a folder she was carrying and handing it to Dansby. "You want to start by going over them?" Dansby scanned it for a moment. "Not really," he said. Amy huffed at him melodramatically. "Aaron, we really have to... Look, Kemp's going to be solid. He always is. Let's not waste our time with that," Dansby said. "What I want to know is... what's Coke Mom's lawyer going to do? Her whole thing is that the drugs aren't really hers, right?"
"Yeah."
"Okay. How's she going to convince the judge of that? And that's what I was trying to think about while I was coming in this morning. If I were her attorney, what would I be doing?"
Amy sat up a little straighter. Maybe the last 3+ years hadn't been completely lost on Dansby after all.
"Well, that's a great question," she said. "I actually haven't checked if there are any subpoenas yet. Hang on." In Virginia, neither side was required to submit a witness list as part of discovery. The only way the defense tipped its hand as to who it might call is if it has to ask the court to issue a subpoena, which it often did if it was afraid a witness wouldn't show up. Any requests for subpoenas had to be issued within 10 days of trial, and trial was now exactly 10 days away. Amy picked up the phone on Dansby's desk and dialed the extension for Judge Robbins's clerk. After the woman answered, Amy bantered with her for a moment or two, then moved to the reason for her call. "Has the defense asked for any subpoenas in CR 18000-15700? She asked, referencing Commonwealth versus Barrick by its case number. "Hang on," the clerk said. She clacked her keyboard for a little bit. Then the woman came back with, "Yeah, a request came in yesterday. Let's see. They asked us to serve Bobby Ray Walters of 102 Desper Hollow Road in Stanton." Amy recognized the address from having recently pinned it on her map. It made him Melanie Barrick's neighbor. He was probably being called to testify that he had never seen any undue amount of traffic in and out of the neighborhood. Which was fine. The Commonwealth didn't have to prove where Barrick did her selling, just that she possessed more drugs than any one human being needed for personal consumption. There was more keyboard clacking. Then the clerk said, "Oh, and you're going to love this. They asked us to serve Demetrius Myers at the Haynesville Correctional Center."
"Mookie Myers?" Amy blurted, causing Dansby's face to furrow.
"To know him is to love him," the clerk said.
"Okay," Amy said. "Anyone else?"
"Nope. But I'll give you a call if anything else comes in."
"Thanks," Amy said. Dansby had his arms crossed.
"Did I hear that right? The defense is subpoenaing Mookie Myers?"
"Yep."
"Why would they do that?"
"No idea. The sheriff's theory was that Barrack had taken over Myers's operation. She was selling the same brand and had the same customers. But whether that's true or not, it really doesn't have a lot of bearing on the case.
Dansby drummed his fingers for a moment.
What if Mookie comes in and says, "No way I let this cracker lady take over my turf,"
Dansby asked, making Amy cringe with his attempted imitation of Myers's voice. First, I doubt he would do that. He'd be screwing up his own appeal. Second, so what? She was caught with the drugs. That's the only thing that counts.
I realize that, but I'm worried this means there's something going on we haven't thought of.
Yeah, Amy said. Me too.
So what do we do about it?
Dansby asked, already sounding a little panicky about it.
Amy stared at the desk for a moment.
We just have to make sure we don't open the door.
What do you mean?
I mean, under no circumstances do we mention the name Mookie Myers when we present our case. We don't talk about him during our opening. We don't ask Kemp about him. Then if the defense tries to start talking about Mookie Myers, we object and say it's not relevant. Normally, it's the prosecution that has to work to build a foundation for certain evidence, and it's the defense that's trying to tear it down. We'll just turn the tables on them.
Think that'll work?
Maybe, Amy said.
I guess we'll find out.
Chapter 50. Roughly a week and a half into my stay, and it was getting hard to keep track of the days when every one of them was the same, I was doing the important work that was lying on my bed, staring up at the ceiling. Then my meal slot opened. It was after lunch and not quite time for dinner, so I knew what that meant. I was already swinging my feet onto the floor.
"Come on, Barrack. Yard time," I heard.
Through the door's square window, I saw the tightly wound braids and ample body of Officer Brown, my perhaps acquaintance from some time I couldn't remember. I got myself to my feet and, like the obedient chattel I was, shoved my hands through the slot.
"Are you going to give me any trouble, Barrack?" she asked.
"No, Officer Brown. Of course not."
"Then I think we can skip this step," she said.
It had been so long since anyone had shown me even minimal kindness. I was actually suspicious. Was this some kind of a trick? Was I being set up for something? She had been nice to me before, but that was just softening me up for... what? I felt a little unsteady as she opened the door for me and led me down the hallway. I had already become so habituated to slinking along with my wrists bound, I actually put my hands in front of me as I walked. It felt more natural that way. Officer Brown loomed behind me until we made it outside. When we reached the cage where I would spend the next hour, she unlocked it for me, swinging open the chain-link door. The cage was wedged in the gap between two buildings that were several stories high, so it only received direct sunlight during a few hours in the middle of the day. It was now so late I had already missed my chance. The last rays were at least 10 feet over my head, reflecting off the wall nearest the cage. It was, unless I was mistaken, April 2nd. My trial was exactly a week away. The day was warm, and I suppose I was cognizant that the seasons were changing, or had already changed. It would be another lovely spring in the Shenandoah Valley, even if that sort of thing was mostly an abstract concept for someone who spent 23 hours a day inside. Officer Brown still hadn't locked my cage, which increased my unease. First, no handcuffs. Now this. Was she trying to make this look like an escape attempt? What was the penalty for that?
Was there something worse than ADSEG? Then Officer Brown asked,
You still don't remember me, do you?
I looked up at her, this imposing woman, and searched my brain one more time.